following seminar, led by James Dorado, was delivered at 12 o'clock p.m. on March the 8th, 1973, for a youth ministry seminar held at Asbury Theological Seminary. The seminar was recorded through the facilities of Asbury Theological Seminary and is now made available to you through the seminary's tape library. Additional copies may be ordered by contacting the tape library and giving complete identification of the seminar. Ownership privileges must be observed, and this seminar must not be transcribed without the specific consent of the seminary. Now here is James Dorado speaking on the subject, the pastor's role in establishing youth ministry in the smaller church.
Jim, it's all yours.
Thank you, sir. I begin to feel after a while like some of you have been so totally saturated with so much that's been said. I feel that way. We've talked about many, many things, and we've looked at this business of youth ministry from many perspectives, which I'm sure some of you did not anticipate. It would have been a lot easier for many of you if we had probably done what you had hoped. Come in with a manual, 35 pages on better ways to build a youth group, 10 programs for sure success, and the 10 biggest youth programs and how they grew. Being personally hostile and antagonistic and highly resentful. How's that come off? Particularly towards the large group, large Sunday school concept. I have a very keen interest in the local pastor in the smaller church. Now, I think from our youth ministries class this morning, and very cognizant of some of the deficiencies of this kind of a very brief program, I am neither prepared at this point, nor had I intended to speak specifically to the needs of student pastors or part-time youth ministers. I know that's where many of you are at this point. And as I suggested in the youth ministries class, it might be a very valuable thing if, as a result of this, I saw Bill Couch sitting here somewhere. Is Bill here? Yeah, there he is. Yeah. It would be very helpful if maybe some of you would submit to Bill some suggestions. Now, I know there will be an instrument later on that will try to determine the value of this program in terms of the input and all this. But I think beyond that, it might be valuable for you to give to Bill suggestions about some specific areas of youth ministry that we have not touched on, and some areas that might prove helpful in terms of discussion that might come even before another formal presentation is presented. I think if you do this again next year, it would be tragic if some of you would wait around till next year with notebook in hand to get something more in terms of what to do with young people. There's a lot of things that you're having to grapple with individually. And I'd be glad, personally, you know, to come back in and spend a couple of days with some of you men that are pastors who are students and maybe do an analysis and a review of your particular location as to what the potential is for you and how you might best try to approach your specific situation. It becomes an extremely difficult thing to do, though, when we're trying to deal with a broad perspective of youth, and also when we're trying to think in terms of where you're going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and not just where you are today. So even much of what I said last night about this matter of biblical principles and convictions, I hope is being filed somewhere in the computer of your thinking for whatever value it may be to you a year, 5, 10, 15 years from now, as you begin to come to grips with young people that are experiencing some things right now that will not surface for another 5 years in communities that have been previously unaffected by this kind of thing. I don't want to be too repetitious because I've just gotten through this in a class from which I just came, but I do feel it's important to point out that what I said last night, the rural youth, the classic stereotype of the rural youth, I believe in another 5 to 10 years will be almost non-existent. With the exception of some few more remote areas of our country, most young people are subject to several things that are happening. Number one, the consolidated school is exposing children from little quiet communities like Wilmore to young people who are now the children of those who are moving out of Lexington into Jessamine County because of home sites and because of super highways that make it easy for them to get back to work. And the little child from back in the hill who drives, gets the school bus way down the road near Highbridge, is now sitting as a junior in a class with a kid whose parents are in the $45,000 bracket and who have moved from the north to work in IBM on the south side of Lexington, but who have built a home in Jessamine County. And so that kid, maybe incapable as he is of handling much of what he's hearing and having little context or few categories to properly interpret the words that are being used, he is being exposed to something that is totally foreign to the world in which he's been born and raised, and to the parents to whom he relates. And it might take a couple of years for this to surface. But I think that the Consolidated School in the rural community is doing a great deal to broaden the perspective far beyond that of the viewpoint of the parent or even the local church. Good, bad, or indifferent, whether you like it or not, it's something we're going to have to come to grips with in the next few years. You're not going to have as many protected young people. Obviously, the second thing is that travel is changing tremendously, this perspective of young people. The fact that kids from all kinds of little rural communities are suddenly becoming exposed to things that otherwise they would have never been aware of by virtue of the highways, the reduced rates for college students, the travel that's being done by, you know, kids used to go to New York, that was the big thing for their senior class. Now senior classes in many areas across the country are preparing for tours to London and Paris. Why not? If they can get a chartered flight, they can do it almost as cheap as they can going to New York or to Washington. For a fact, they can. Now, I know this may not be the big thing in Hazard or McAuliffe County right now. You know, Breathitt County may not be inundated with a lot of travel agents trying to get up charter groups to London. But the fact is, it is happening with an increasing amount of regularity, and young people are beginning to see things they've never seen before. I remember the workshop in Christian Revolution that our organization sponsored in New York City about 3 years ago between Christmas and New Year's. And a whole gang of young people came from a very small, lovely little Christian college out in southern Indiana. And it was their first exposure to many things. And we put them into some rather hairy situations. We sent 15 from one college in Indiana to talk with the militant Puerto Ricans who had taken over the Methodist Church in the Bronx. And if you'll remember, they took it over and they had sandbags and all the rest, and they had an arsenal, and they were demanding that that church begin to minister to the community, because everybody came in from the outside, the typical, you know, church that survives from suburban money and all. And they had a big playground that was never open. They wanted a daycare center. The Puerto Rican people wanted a daycare center there. They wanted to use the playground and all that. And so they had it, and it became a citadel, in fact, because they took it over. And the court, of course, presented them with an injunction, a show cause injunction as to why they should not release the property. And, of course, nobody could get near to it for the guns and all the rest. Well, we had a contact on the inside, and we used that contact to send 15 of these college students from central Indiana, most of which came from Indiana and Michigan and Illinois and so forth. And they went up there, and the doors were opened, and they filed in, and they were put against the wall, and they were frisked. And you know, with some chick from central Indiana at the age of 17 gets frisked, it's kind of a new experience for her. And they sat and they talked for 3 hours in this context. And they came back, and their heads were like, you know, whirling. And the idea was not for us to so totally wipe them out, but to expose them to some thinking which otherwise they never got except reading a book. Now that was, you know, an exciting experience for them. But this is happening in high schools now. Field trips and all this kind of thing. And kids are being exposed, and mom and dad doesn't know how to handle it, and the quiet little church doesn't know how to integrate these kids. We have to write them off as freaks. We have to write them off as weirdos or hippies or something, which are all terms that come out of the mentality of the late 1960s that are even, for the most part, non-existent today. But there's still people running around talking about hippies. Or, you know, this kind of thing, which shows where their mentality is. But it's changing. It's radically changing. And we've got to reckon with this. Not so much that every young person is there today, but there is a movement in that direction. And then, obviously, mass media changes the attitudes and the insights of many of our young people. And it changes their attitudes and insights, for though parents watch television, and the news. You know, one father said, I refuse to allow my children to be exposed to the corruption of television. I refuse to allow them to be so totally influenced by the sex and the violence and all the corruption in television programming. And one of the other men said, well, then how do your kids get to know what's going on in the world if you've made them stop watching the news? Because that's what's there. It's there in front of them. But the parent who's watching this in some remote community, whose world is structured and with... And they feel comfortable with their world. Their world is never going to be dislodged. They've lived there for 50 years. They've paid their mortgage. They've owned their car. They work 40 hours a week. They're content. They're happy. And why shouldn't they be? I'm not knocking it. It's just that as they watch those television programs, that's very remote from them. First of all, they don't ever have to wear khaki or go to war. Secondly, there are none of them black people living that close to them, so they don't have to worry about all their foolishness. Thirdly, their economy is reasonably stable. They don't have any heavy debts. They don't have to be threatened. But the kid who's watching that same news program, the kid who's watching that same thing, the one who's watching the piped-in educational program in the school or the new audiovisual aids that are being given, he's watching it from a little different context. And so his mind is moving in a different direction. And so I think it's important that you recognize that we've got to be thinking through a lot of things for the sake of where we're going to be in a few years from now. All right? We want to talk here today about the pastor's role in establishing youth ministry in a smaller church. I have to find these things in the midst of a otherwise interesting kind of schedule. Incidentally, this is the last really full presentation that I'm going to do. And so I want to say to you men here, thank you for the opportunity to share. I'm not so certain that you've learned anything that you're going to be able to go back and immediately implement. I hope we've created some provocation, disturbed you a little bit. I don't really even care whether you agree with me or not. I just hope that if you don't agree and you have a firmer conviction in another direction, it's been provoked and challenged so that you've evaluated and you're certain that you're really thinking it through and not just repeating what's already been said or heard. I think a classic statement here, which probably is unrelated to everything else, but it's so beautiful, I got to drop it on you, is the one that was made by Dr. Overstreet, Harry Overstreet, in his book, The Mature Mind, when he was confronted by a teacher who, rather negative in her response to his criticism of teaching, said, well, I want you to know, I've had 35 years of experience teaching. To which Overstreet responded, I don't think you've had 35 years of experience teaching. I think you've had 1 year of experience teaching, and you've repeated it 34 times. There are a lot of men that are going into the ministry today that have had 1 year of experience, and unfortunately, oftentimes, that was their student pastorate or their first year or two. And then they repeat it for 35 years. And there's nothing very fluid or dynamic about their development and growth. The pastor's role in establishing youth ministry in the smaller church. Now, there are certain things we'll assume about a smaller church, all right? We'll assume that the pastor has a smaller church. If he has one, this means that his congregation is smaller. Generally, it means his youth group is smaller. We talk about how in the world is a pastor going to get leadership for this great youth group if his congregation is so small. Well, the chances are you won't have a great youth group for which to have to get. You won't need 15 sponsors out of a congregation of 30 when only four are teenagers. You don't quite need that kind of a ratio. It also means that frequently your facility is smaller. Now, that is not true in the urban situation. And having pastored small congregations in the urban situation, I am familiar with the gigantic edifice with which you are condemned when you move into that situation. I think of Philadelphia particularly. I was a member of the Philadelphia Conference for 7 years, and I think of the some of the Methodist churches in Philadelphia. Fortunately, I happen to have one of the smaller buildings, but I think about some of them in Center City that are gigantic, that seat 2,000 and all the rest, and you've got 100 people rattling around inside. But for the most part, you're going to go to a situation where your facility is also smaller. Now,
I think that we look at the three things, and so we have to recognize what's going to have to happen. The first thing is, in the smaller congregation, we're going to have to develop some leadership. And this may seem very elemental, but the fact is, many pastors are running around not even knowing where to begin. They're in a church for 3 or 4 years, and all they keep saying is, I wish we could do something more with our youth. I wish we could do something more with getting some leadership and some help, but I just hope we'll have somebody who's interested. If you believe what I said about fables and facts yesterday, you might not find it as hard to find leadership. Because if you believe what I said about fables and facts, you will not necessarily look for the youngest, broad, grinning, curly-haired, convertible-driving couple that has just moved to town. That will not be the criteria for leadership. As a matter of fact, you might find some dear man whose children, own children, are now raised, but has a sensitivity and a concern for the youth. He may not be a swinger. He may not be, you know, zapped with all kinds of insights about where the adolescent world is, but he's not threatened by them. As a matter of fact, you will often find that the oldest people in your church are threatened the least by the young people. It's those that are somewhere between 35 and 50 that really get shook up with them. They're most threatened and most vulnerable. I'm not necessarily suggesting you start out by looking for somebody that's in his 60s, but I sure wouldn't pass them by because they were in their 60s. If they don't become a youth sponsor, I want it to be something other than their chronological age that disqualifies them. I want to say this too, because some of you misunderstood me the day before yesterday. If somebody plays the guitar and is a good basketball player and wears long hair and has groovy clothes, that doesn't disqualify him from being a youth minister. As a matter of fact, if those characteristics are true and he can use them to his advantage, I think he should. I use everything that I've got going for me to my advantage, except for the fact whatever particular gifts I have that I have tried to refine and develop are still not my criteria. Because there are too many other guys that have none of the gifts that I have that are doing equally as well and better in some situations. So I'm not against the guy who plays the guitar. If you can, that's beautiful. If you can get the kids together around the campfire and play the guitar and sing with them, I think that's great. God bless you. But don't figure you're going to make it the rest of your life on the basis of how well you play the guitar or in fashions or athletic ability or anything else. So I'm not looking for either. What I'm looking for is a couple, preferably a man and his wife in the church, who are interested and willing to commit themselves to being a help to me as the pastor in working with youth. Now, I think there are 3 or 4 things that are important if we're going to develop this kind of leadership. First of all, I think they've got to see their role in terms of working with these young people, because you might only have 8 or 10. No, you know, no big thing. They don't have to plan gigantic services. They don't have to be concerned about, you know, the ongoing of some very complex program. You've got 10 or 15 young people. We're going to work with whom we've got. I think they have to understand they're working, first of all, with the pastor. If you give those people the idea that you're going to launch them out there into this task to sink or survive on their own, you're going to scare them before they begin, and I don't blame them for not taking the opportunity. Now listen to me, because these are we've been talking theoretical. This is very practical. It's very practical. If I want an adult couple to accept the responsibility of working as youth sponsors, they're going to have to see that that responsibility has a direct relationship to me as the pastor. No, I can't be there at every youth meeting. No, I am not going to write the programs for them. But I am going to be working with them as their advisor and as their counselor and as their helper. And if you don't have the time to do that, then please don't ask them to take the task or the job. Because number one, under that, if you're trying to keep notes, this is so, you know, maybe disorganized, it's hard to do. But number one, if you don't have time to give them counsel or direction, you're not being fair to them or to the young people. And what's worse, you will not have control of what's being said. And no matter how well-meaning they are, and no matter how fine the group of young people, young Christians are vulnerable. They're tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. And as the pastor, I want to know what's being said to those young people.
because those young people in that group are not being worked with as a separate entity, but they are being dealt with as a part of the whole body. Therefore, if what they're being taught does not allow them to come back and healthfully relate to the whole body, I want to know it, because I don't want that kind of teaching going on. Now, I am not for the papacy within the local congregation, but I am autocratic to the degree that if I am there as a shepherd of this flock, I don't want somebody else taking 10 of them off into another field to do their nibbling of the grass. I dig that this morning, all right? Because some of these sheep are getting lost because they've got other sheep taking them somewhere else. And they need to follow the shepherd. However, if I can help one of the sheepdog to herd in some of those who stray from time to time and give some direction, fine. But the sheepdog has got to work under the direction of the shepherd. And so on the one hand, I want them. So if I don't have the time to teach them and train them, then maybe better I should have no youth program at all. And in some smaller churches, I think you can survive reasonably well without any stated youth program. Now, please don't tell your district superintendent I said that, because I'll get run out of town on a rail. But I think rather than do something wrong, it's better to do nothing at all. And the old adage upon which most evangelical churches function, something better than nothing, is a damnable one. Because something is not better than nothing if something being done is being done erroneously, which is going to leave scars and problems that have got to be dealt with and overcome then for the next 10 years. And some of you men ought to understand that better than I do, because you've got a student pastorate where the clod that was there last year did nothing but sit around and eat corn pone and fried chicken and never fed those people anything spiritually, and you've inherited that mess, and it's taking you this whole year to build a new sense of credibility to the ministry and to the minds of those people. It had almost been better if they didn't have a pastor last year. I know that's heavy. But I would almost rather you'd not just go out and tell somebody, hey, go do something with the young people. Because you're feeding a basic philosophy that's not true. Those kids are not being dealt with apart from the total body of believers. They need to work in relationship to you. Number two, I think if these leaders are going to work with you in this situation, they've got to have some realistic goals. They've got to know what it is they're supposed to do with these kids. And bless their hearts, I don't mind. I really can understand why a lot of youth sponsors cop out. Because they don't know really where they're supposed to go, and nobody's told them. You hand them Omega or Alpha materials, Success with Youth. Boy, there's a lot of tremendous stuff that Success with Youth puts out, particularly for the counselor. Very helpful stuff. Or you hand them Gospel Light. I think some of the greatest stuff being written today is by Fritz Ridenour for young people and Gospel Light material. And the packages that come along with that stuff, How to Be a Christian in a Non-Christian World, have you seen that? The Other Side of Morality, How to Be a Christian Without Being Religious. Man, this guy is really speaking right to where kids are asking questions today. But, you know, as great as the material is, Success with Youth, Gospel Light, Scripture Press, David Zagook, whatever it is, just to put it in the hands of the sponsor and say, go to it. I think you as a pastor need to have some overall goals for your entire church, and then see where the goals of, or how this affects the program of your youth and what the goals are. I think those goals ought to include several things. I think there ought to be a numerical goal. I don't think that's so wrong. I think it's so awful to say, hey, we've had 10 this year. We ought to have at least 15 or 18. We've got more kids than that coming to Sunday school. Why aren't they involved in the other aspects of the church? I think there ought to be numerical goals, but I think they ought to be realistic. I don't think they ought to be the driving force, but they ought to be something of a goal that gives us an idea of whether we've gotten anywhere near where we started out to go. I think we need to have some content goals. And I call them content goals, but what is it you want these kids to learn this year? What kind of content or information do you want to deal with and cover this year? What kind of a test should they be able to pass when they come to this end of the year theologically? And bless your hearts, we don't have any goals for our kids content-wise for the most part. As long as they're out there winning souls for Jesus, and a lot of them are coming, and they're excited about the Lord, and they're waving a finger in the air and something else, we really think things are great. But man, I know and you know that it's the content that's going to make the difference 5 to 10 years from now. What kind of content do I want to cover this year? Some goals. I think there are as well some spiritual goals. In other words, what kind of function do I want these young people to be able to perform within the church at the end of this year? I can't expect them to be good stewards of everything this year. Great honk. They don't even know themselves where they are in terms of stewardship in life because they're not even sure of who they are. They're still caught up in something of an identity search. But there ought to be certain aspects of the church life that they can feel, that they can begin to identify with. Maybe this year our real emphasis is going to be missions. Maybe this year one of the things we want to do for our kids is really expose them to a world view. And maybe this year that's going to include a trip to Mount Carmel, or it's going to mean a trip to Redbird or some mission station where they can get a view of what's being done. And maybe it's going to mean not just bringing in some missionary guy with his 45 slides, but bringing somebody in who can come sit down and really talk realistically to these kids about what's involved in the mission field. And maybe that's the only thing we want to accomplish this year, but it's a goal and it fits into the overall ministry of the church. But we've got a ministry. This year we want to really emphasize sharing our faith. And we're really going to deal with this thing. We're going to learn the Kennedy program, or Campus Crusade is going to come in, or somebody's going, but we're going to work this thing this year. That's a goal. We'd like to see of our 10 kids, at least 5 of them ready to really share Jesus Christ by the end of the year. Or maybe that's too many. But I'm going to establish some kind of a goal. There's something I'm looking for to happen. You see, if I can tell my youth sponsors, just maybe one couple, I don't need 10 couples because I've only got 15 kids. But if I can spend some time with that couple talking about goals and how their program fits into the light of those goals, because they're overall goals for the whole church, then they can feel somewhat comfortable that they're going somewhere specifically. I think the third thing is they need to have, well, for the lack of a better word, a job description. Greek and Hebrew were never a real problem for me. It's always been English. You know, a job description is helpful in everything. I feel like every pastor ought to have a job description. I think every pastor's secretary ought to have a job description. Tell you, one of the most helpful things to my secretary is I gave her a job description that not only tells her what she does, it also tells her what she's not responsible for. And she likes that, because when somebody calls and says something that deals with an aspect of the work in the office, she can very freely and comfortably say, "I'm sorry, I have no responsibility at that point. I'll have to refer you to Mr. Dorado." It's very helpful to her, because she feels comfortable working within a certain framework. You know why a lot of youth sponsors don't make it? Because they have an image in their own mind of what a youth sponsor is. And it may not at all be what you have in mind, but they don't know what you have in mind. And they envision themselves running around with a bunch of kids in their car all the time, and kids flooding their basement and having pizza parties and feeding kids all hours of the day and night, and running to all the youth activities and having to get cars lined up to take kids to the district hymn sing or whatever else is happening. And they begin to see this as almost a full, and it frightens them. And I think you've got to sit down and develop a realistic job description for them. You may not want to call it that, but I think if you'd sit down and say, "Look, we'd like you to be the youth sponsors. Here are 2 or 3 goals we'd like to try to work toward this year. And I want you to know, if there's a district hymn sing, that it's not your responsibility to go out and get all the cars to do that. We've got a fellow over here that is a mechanic, and he works on cars, and he can't get up and talk to kids. He's scared to death of young people. He could never be a youth sponsor. At least at this point, he doesn't want to have anything to do with it. But I asked him, if the 4 times this year when we got youth programs going, if we would help the line up transportation, he said he'd do it. So that's not your job. And incidentally, we don't expect you to be putting out a lot of money from your pocket to entertain kids. That's not your job. Here are specifically the things we'd like you to do. Help the kids to develop their program, planning sessions. We would like you to be responsible to follow kids up to see that they do the jobs that they've been given. We would like you to act as the liaison between these young people and me as the pastor. And if there's a problem that arises or a difficulty that comes up, would you please tell that young person that you'd like to talk to me about them, or bring them with you to talk to me about it, so that you can help me to know what's going on if it's serious. Now, they're the only 3 things I want you to do as a youth sponsor. If other things come up along the way, talk to me about it. I may not be to any of your youth programs. I'll try to get to some. But we've got a commission meeting over here the same hour, or with moms and dads in another training program the same hour. But if there's something comes up, let me know, because we're going to work out these goals and these responsibilities. That's all you have to do. So the person comes running back to you right away and says, well, wow, you said that was all I have to do, but look what's come up. I've done this, this, and this, and this. All right, we're going to have to find maybe another person to do just this one job. And you know, it's not tough to get a person to do a job. It's much tougher to get them to take a responsibility. It's much tougher if I say to an individual, I want you to be responsible for all the extracurricular activities of the young people. It's not so difficult to go to the individual and say, hey, we got something coming up. Could you help me for this job to get 5 cars? I need 5 cars. Would you help me out on that? And they can respond to that. They get frightened with a title and with a tag. And besides, I don't need them all the time. I don't want everybody coming to all the youth planning sessions. I don't want everybody involved in all this. It confuses the young people and also takes too much time from the others, particularly if I've only got 10 or 15 kids in my youth group. See, I've never had a church with more than 15 young people in my youth group. I've never pastored a big church. I've never functioned on a multiple staff. I've done some work in some churches where they do. But I found it was much easier for me, working in a smaller church, to get one couple to feel like they were basically responsible for this, and then maintain a great deal of interest and let others know that they have a continuing responsibility with it too. And so I think it begins by recognizing we have to develop leadership with a pastor, with realistic goals, with a job description that doesn't blow the minds of these people and make them feel like they're becoming an assistant pastor. It's too much. They run. And I don't blame them. Let me move on quickly then, just a few more minutes, because we're going to talk about the youth group next. How much should the pastor be involved in the youth group itself? Again, in the smaller church, of course in the larger too, I feel very keenly about that, but in the smaller church, I think the pastor ought to give himself as much exposure to his young people as he can. I think he ought to give himself as much exposure to his young people as he can. I don't think he should be second-guessing the leadership that he has invited to be sponsors. I don't think he can be second-guessing. If you don't like what they do or you think it could be done better, call them aside and have a meeting with them. Don't second-guess them. Don't be moving into the youth program to sort of, you know, do your thing because they're not. Help them. Give them direction. Oh, let me say this too. Help them, give them direction. Try to help your leadership to get instruction. There's loads of material, but don't give them 50 books. Find one or two good ones that represent something of your feeling and your thought. Don't give them 50. Larry Richards' book, Youth Ministry, is great. I think every pastor ought to read it so he understands what he's looking for when he talks about a youth sponsor, or if you ever get into a church where there's a multiple staff, you have a good idea of what you're looking for in associate or assistant or Christian ed director, whatever. But I don't think the book, A Youth Ministry, really will go down too easily with most of your youth sponsors. But I think there are other helpful booklets even being published. Success with Youth has a whole series of booklets and tapes that they've been producing. You don't have to teach that thing. All you have to do is maybe get together a few of your interested people and ask them to listen to some of the tapes. Discuss it. But there's a lot of material and information that can be helpful. Expose your people to as much of it as you can. I just did a family life conference down in Norfolk, Virginia. The assistant pastor of a church in York, Pennsylvania, brought his wife and a couple of others down to see what we were doing and to listen to our discussions. I was down in Washington, D.C., and when I was down there, he brought 5 men with him from the board of deacons of his church, because he knew that if they heard me say it in the big conference in Washington with 800 people, they'd pay attention. But if he went back and tried to say it to the 5 of them, they'd call him a radical. So wherever I am in the area, he always shows up with 3 or 4 of his men. And their attitudes are changing radically toward what he's doing by just exposing them to instruction. And there's lots of it available today. So give them the benefit of this kind of help. Oftentimes, somebody else can say it better than you can. They'll even come back and say to you, boy, I wish we'd thought of that. And before you smash them right in the face, pray and say, thank you, Lord, at least they heard somebody else say it and understand it, even though they didn't hear it me when I said it five times. So it's instruction. I think you've got to give yourself exposure to your own youth group. Now, every one of you will not feel as free to relax with a gang of young people. But I think you've got to be honest about it. I think you've got to be honest about how you feel with young people. I was in a church speaking in an evangelistic series a couple of years ago. And the pastor came to me one night and sat down and said, Jimmy, these kids scare me to death. And he said, what's worse, they know it. He said, I'm not really sure I like them. You know, he said, I love them. And the weird thing is, this guy's church has had dozens of guys go out into the ministry. So it was not, you know, a serious calamitous situation. It was just, he was sensitive to the fact that he didn't have a good, easygoing relationship with him. And I spent that week with him trying to help him to understand something about himself. See, he had so many stereotypes in his mind as to what young people responded to. He didn't understand that most of the young people really loved him and felt sorry for him because they knew how awkward he was. And they just wished he wouldn't feel awkward because they liked him as he was. But you see, he's very straight, very conservative, ultra-separationist, losing some of his hair, a little pudgy, and very heavy into theology, and he just didn't feel that anybody, the kids, would like him. So he was always kind of uptight when he was around them. Now, he was smart enough to get around him in his church, since he had no assistant, no associate, nobody else to do it. He was smart enough to get around him, a couple of couples, and he prayed with them and showed them what he wanted and what he felt needed to happen. And they were developing a good youth ministry. And between his good preaching on Sunday morning and their valid ministry with the young people on Sunday night, they had a good balance and those kids were growing and they were going out into the ministry. But you know, I said to him, I said, look, I'm doing a rap thing with the kids Saturday night. Why don't you come? Well, he said, I won't know what to say. I said, well, that's one of your hang-ups right there. Brother, don't say nothing. Just listen. But see, the preacher image and stereotype was so strong, he couldn't conceive of himself being anywhere without dominating the conversation and preaching another sermon, like somebody else I know. And he couldn't conceive of himself just going in and sitting down and listening. But he came. And he came, and as soon as he walked in, he took his tie and jacket off and sat on the floor and joked with some of the kids. I want to tell you what the reaction was, because this will blow your mind. Some of the kids said to me, you know, our pastor really was out of it the other night. We like him just as well with his tie and jacket on, and it'd just been as comfortable if he sat in a chair. I just wished I could help the guy to understand they liked him like he was. Didn't have to do anything. I was down here in a little community called Paintlick, Kentucky, in a revival meeting a couple of years ago. And the president of the youth group, you know where Paintlick is? Just outside of Richmond. The president of the youth group said to me one afternoon when I was talking with him, he said, I wish you'd talk to our pastor, who happened to be, I think at that time, a student at the seminary located in Wilmore. He said, I wish you'd talk to our pastor. He said, I'm quoting now. He said, if our pastor wouldn't act like such a jackass, he said, he embarrasses us. Because he's trying to be like we are. And we really wish he'd just be a pastor and be like he's supposed to be. Well, I don't know what he's supposed to be, but I know that those young people were just kind of wishing that he would just relax and be himself. Not try to be cool, not try to be other, just to be himself. Now, he probably would never be a winner with kids. That is, he might not have some of the basic ingredients that would make it easy for him to communicate on a sustained basis. But I believe they need exposure to him. Because those young people need to establish a healthy relationship with a man who preaches the word on Sunday morning. As a matter of fact, actually, I guess John McGarvey ought to be teaching one of these courses for us. Because he learned some things going through our program in New York City. And one of them was that the cardinal sin, the unforgivable sin, is when a minister to youth or a youth sponsor says anything negative about the pastor to the young people. And the reason John ought to talk about this is because he was in a church where they had a pastor as a real dodo. Oh, no, I'm not supposed to say anything negative. Where the pastor's gifts and proclivities did not allow him to feel too terribly comfortable with many people, let alone young people. Why? Because that pastor is the pastor of that church. The youth minister is not the pastor of the church. He's there to build relationships between those youth and the body. And what about the youth sponsor? What about that couple? That couple must see that they have a responsibility to help build relationships. But if you're never around, it's very tough to build a relationship. And if you're never available to listen to what some kids are saying, it's going to be very hard for you to relate to the world in which they live. And we always tell guys, don't get too negative about the pastor, because you're teaching the young people some bad habits. Hey, you may be the next victim. You teach them how to be critical of the pastor, and they'll say thank you, because now they've learned how to also be critical of the youth minister and of the sponsors and of the Sunday school teachers and of everybody else. And they have learned that this business of going to church is sort of a catch-as-catch-can. It's up in the air, and everybody can do their sort of thing. You've got a responsibility to be available to the kids. And after all, if you've only got 10 or 15 kids, or maybe only 8 in a small church, then why would it not be possible for you as a pastor to have the kids stop by to the parsonage some Sunday night for Coke and just talk with you and share with you some things as to where they are? And so I feel that as far as the youth group is concerned, you need, the three or four things I've said here. You need, one, exposure. You need, two, that is, they need exposure to you and you to them. They need to know what you're like. They need to see you outside of that pulpit as a human being, so that when you stand in the pulpit, it is, in fact, human communication that's taking place, and not the oracle of God speaking ex cathedra to us peons down here. Because this is the way a lot of kids come off. It's just a matter of exposure. It doesn't mean you've got to spend hours with them, but it means an hour well spent can have a significant influence or impact on the way they listen to you. Though I know in my own home church, which we attend, our pastor accompanied our young people on a trip to Tennessee, in which they did their youth camp for 3 days, and he rode the bus down with them and back. And I think it's done more to change the attitude of our kids toward the preaching ministry than probably anything else that's happened. And he didn't go down to be a good Joe or swinging guy. He just was himself. He's a rather quiet self. He's a rather reserved personality. Kids found out that he feels like everybody else and that he responds like everybody else. It just isn't as obvious, and they've come to really love him as he is. Made a tremendous difference. Just exposure. I think, too, that as well as exposure, the pastor needs to be listening. And I'll tell you, you're going to learn more about your deacons or your stewards or your church leaders by listening to the kids than you'll ever learn from most anywhere else. Ooh, will you listen and hear and learn? It could prove to be just downright devastating. As I said yesterday, I forget where, but in one of the sessions, don't always be too ready to believe everything you hear, because young people are prone at times to somewhat overemphasize. I said that in a class, didn't I? Or was it here yesterday? Huh? It was one of the lectures. But the kid, you know, comes off and says, "My parents beat me all over." And if you really keep pressing them, you'll find out that what happened was the parents said, "Please don't do that." So don't be too ready to... But you can learn a lot from how they're reacting emotionally by listening, and I think it'll help your preaching. And then I feel that you're as a pastor, somewhere along the line, in the course of your ministry, you need to spend some time teaching them. As a pastor in a church, I always asked for one Sunday night out of every 2 months. That's not many. That's only 6 Sunday nights. But I asked for 6 Sunday nights out of our MYF program when I wanted to have charge of the program. That's not many. I wasn't there in most of the others, but there were 6 Sunday nights when I was going to be there. all the other programs, I knew what was happening because we were part of the planning that went into it. Incidentally, another practical aspect, and I don't know how you could implement this in your own church, but what I did with my young people and my youth sponsors was we planned our church program for the youth a year at a time. Now, many of you that use the Omega material, or many of you that use the regular MYF material or the Gospel Light material, would not need to do this. Because of the rather strange heterogeneous makeup of the youth group that I had, particularly in Philadelphia, it was difficult to implement some of the basic programs that were handed. So we had what was called a day apart. We left right after breakfast. We came home right before dinner or evening meal, and we took our lunch with us. The morning began with brainstorming. We said to the kids, what are some of the areas that you want to discuss? And so from around 8:30 until around 11:30, that's that way, isn't it? Well, that says 10:30. I have a little problem this hour with that. My blood sugar is low. This was mostly brainstorming. And during that brainstorming session, we asked questions like, what areas would you like to discuss? What do you think are issues? What are some of the problems you're facing in your own spiritual life that you would like us to talk about? And we put loads of things down, and we gleaned through and got reactions and ideas. And as brainstorming goes, we didn't throw anything out initially. Everything got written down. And we evaluated, and we worked. 11:30, we took a break. At 12 o'clock, we ate. And at 1 o'clock, we were back again. At 1 o'clock, I laid out before them on a board my entire church calendar. That is, I struck off September through August, each month broken down into however many Sundays there were. And when I drew this out for them on the board, which didn't take long because all it was a matter of doing was saying, here's September, and here's 1, 2, 3, 4 Sundays, here's October, and I went on down the line like that. Then I said to the kids that were there, now, we've got a lot of things we want to deal with, a lot to talk about. But first of all, I want you to know that this first Sunday is Stewardship Sunday. And it's Worldwide Community Sunday. But let's say, for a safe example, it's Stewardship Sunday. Now, that particular day, we're going to have an emphasis in all of our meetings, and I'll be responsible for your youth meeting on that Sunday night. And I'll be asking some of you young people to help me plan a program that will do this. But we're going to tie that whole thing in. Then way over here in February, I said, gang, in February, this week, we have planned a missions conference. And so I would like to work with you on planning that. In other words, I wanted, wherever there was a major thrust in the church, I wanted the young people involved in that major thrust. You know, I've gone into evangelistic crusades in a church, and on a Sunday night, young people were off doing something totally unrelated to the evangelistic crusade. Blew my mind. I said, well, what time's young people's on Sunday night? 6. Will I be able to get to speak to the young people? Oh, no, we have our program that runs independently. Well, man, it can't afford to run independently. It's got to discover that what they're doing as young people ties into the ongoing total program of the church. And so I went through the calendar, and I showed them the Sundays that were already committed because of a basic major thrust. There was evangelism, there was missions, there was stewardship. There was a period of training that we had and witnessing and so forth, and I wanted the youth to be a total part of that. Then we went back and we looked at the months and we said, all right, now, here are the Sundays that we have yet open. We brainstormed, what are the areas we want to discuss? And we would break down certain areas under these brainstorming. For instance, a number of kids talked about sex, dating, or something like that. So we said, okay, dating is one of the subjects we want to cover. But that's not enough to say dating because that's worn out. Kids are talking about that all the time. What specifically do we want to talk about and what areas? And so we come up with 3 or 4 areas. They'd like to have a medical doctor come in and talk to them. They'd like to have somebody talk about the emotional problems. We'd like to have somebody read The Stork is Dead and have a panel discussion and reaction to what Charlie Shedd has said. We want somebody to read Evelyn Duval's book, Why Wait Till Marriage, and we want to have some reaction. All right, so we come up. We say, okay, the month of September, for 4 Sunday nights, we're going to deal with this area. They say, well, we don't have time. We say, okay, we'll run over into this one week over here. All right? Now, by the time 1 until about 4:30 comes along, what we've done is we've gone through the entire year and we've talked about basic areas of discovery. which means from now on, our planning never involves what's our subject going to be, but our monthly planning sessions are who is accepting responsibility, and we met a month. We met in September to discuss November, 2 months away. What are the specific areas? I knew where they were going. The youth counselors knew where they were going. They knew where they were going. Nothing came as a big surprise. If there was a major program that we were planning for, Career Day. Kids wanted to talk about careers, options. Well, we knew that was coming up in March, way back in September at our day apart. And so immediately, somebody becomes responsible to contact a doctor, a teacher, a guidance counselor, whoever they're going to bring in for the panel. They've got months in which to do it, and they know where they're going. And our counselors felt comfortable. Because when they were pushing kids to get things done, because you got to call a kid at least 5 times, including an hour after he was supposed to have done it, to remind him that it was supposed to have been done, because that's part of adolescence. And if they don't act like that, they're not being adolescent. You know, I mean, people say, why can't they? Well, that's why they have you around. If kids acted like you did, then we wouldn't need any sponsors. They'd all be perfect. So we expect that that's part of our training, is to teach them to accept responsibility. But it gave us the bird's eye view of the overall school year. And I did something else. Psychologically, it's a fantastic thing when kids know that everybody knows or has an idea of where they're going. One of the things that kills youth programming more than anything else is the fact that Sunday nights become entities, separate entities unto themselves. There's no continuity. Kids don't see themselves as going somewhere. One of the things we tried to do, too, before we left, and we didn't always get it done, we tried to leave with also laying out when our socials were going to be and what they were going to be through the year. So we knew that we were having a big roller skating party the third Saturday night in February. You know what this does to the minds of kids when they come in and you say, hey, gang, don't forget, keep in mind, in December we're doing this, in January we're doing this, in February we're doing this. Wow, that's more organization and preparation than they've heard in a long time. You mean you really know where you're going from here? But the important part of this to me was the fact that it tied itself into the church. That it was a part of the whole program. And they weren't doing their thing over there, and we're doing our thing over here. Oh, I got to quit. Okay. Let me just say this, as far as facility is concerned. I have some very deep feelings about the fact that we're trying to move everything out of the church for the sake of appealing to the rebellious young person. Well, you just can't have that kind of meeting in the church, because if you say the church, kids won't come because they won't come near the church. I'm not so sure that's fair. I really feel that if the kid has that kind of an attitude toward the church, then we need to restructure his thinking. And it may take a little while to do it, but he needs to begin to feel comfortable with it. I mean, I don't know why we have to be so hassled over a building. The young people, young Jesus people saying, we're not going to go down into that building, those big buildings with a stained glass window and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, it wasn't the stained glass window's fault. It wasn't the stone, the brick, and the mortar. I really feel like, you know, it's like the word Catholic. You say the Apostles' Creed, any of you? I believe in the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, because of the resurrection of the body. People say we shouldn't use that word Catholic. It makes it sound like we're Roman Catholic. I say, I'm not going to throw out a perfectly good word because somebody has a poor content. It's my business to educate my people to understand what the right content of the word is. I don't know why we should turn over millions of dollars worth of real estate because some people have got a hang-up about the fact that what has gone on in that real estate from time to time has been dry and boring and prosaic. I think it's time that we begin to restructure the thinking of the people to know that the friendliest place in your community is not your neighborhood tavern. And I know that sometimes we'd like to have better facilities. Sometimes we'd like to have a bigger and better building. But the fact is, if you've got a smaller church, there are only 10 or 15 kids, what do you need a gym for? Why can't you make do what you've got? Except for the fact that if your facilities are in shambles because of poor stewardship of facility, then you've got another problem you've got to reckon with. And brother, I have preached the hoops and hollers of central, southern, and eastern Kentucky. And I can understand why the kid who goes to Jessamine County School over here in that beautiful school and then walks into a Sunday school room with old hymnals stacked there
and with old Sunday school leaflets over here, and with seven different variety of chairs, some of them broken and leaned against the corner for 6 months, begins to feel like just maybe no one here is taking much seriously. I've never pastored a church that had fancy facility, except with the exception, I guess, of Simpson Methodist in Philadelphia, which was a very nice plant, stone church and all. But I don't think you have to have fashionable facilities, big facilities. Don't look with envy upon the guy who's got the gym. That may be a millstone around his neck, brother, and I've been in a few of them where they are. They wish they didn't have them. Look upon the fact that your facility needs to be clean and in good shape, recognizing that your young man or young lady is coming out of a school. And these consolidated schools are pretty sharp, aren't they? You can't have the carpeting and all the fancy fixtures. But I tell you this, I believe you can keep it clean. And I believe you can pick up the garbage. And I don't think the Sunday school room has to become the depository or the storage for everything you don't know where else to put. And I'm talking about a problem that's not just in one or two schools. I'm talking about something that's prevalent because we don't really care for our church property and our Sunday school material and facility as we should. Let me say something else because I've got to go because I don't have much longer before I got to grab something to eat and get back to a class. And you got to go too. But I do believe that some of you with a small ministry can take advantage of what some of the independent ministries are doing. I think you cut your nose to spite your face sometime when you take a militant stand against what some of the independent ministries are doing. I think this is a very local problem. I've been in some localities, and let me say very frankly, even though it's being taped, I was on a staff of Youth for Christ International for 7 years as a Crusade staff evangelist. And I have run into pretty tough situations, and it is no secret, and I do not speak out of the cloistered halls of that sacred organization when I say to you, some Youth for Christ organizations are fantastic and are a real blessing to the local ministries of the church if the local pastor would get off his high horse and quit being so proud and take advantage of some things that can be done in mass that he can't accomplish with his seven kids on Sunday night. On the other hand, I have been in some communities where Youth for Christ and Young Life and Campus Life and IVCF have been militantly obstinate in their being opposed to the local church ministry as such. And I think in that situation, you've got every responsibility to stick to your guns and to defend the fact that God has ordained you as the institution and not them. But don't make any stereotyped conclusion, because I did that when I went to my first church. And a guy from Youth for Christ came to see me, and I almost blew him off the front porch. Until I discovered that I couldn't hope to do with my eight kids on Sunday night what could be accomplished by allowing them to be a part of a Saturday night program that was ministering to 300 or 400 kids in my community. And I began to realize that he wanted to help me, and he didn't want to take my kids anywhere. And I began to utilize their training to train my young people to make them better kids within my church. But the responsibility is first on you to make sure that you're integrating what's being done, and the responsibility is on you to determine whether or not that particular local leader is there to help you or to run his own thing. Don't write them all off. Some of them are doing a fantastic work. And I've come to places like San Diego and Rochester and Baltimore and Washington, PA, and other places where God's using some men in Youth for Christ to really help build some young people's churches, church groups. I've been to some others that have been competitive. But take advantage when you can of the independent organization. They can do things. They got budget. They got guys there that got know-how that you can never have. Don't close yourself off to it, if it in fact can feed your church. Good morning, and God bless you. We're available only from 3 to 4 this evening.